Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 127 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. Listen to us every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on PRN.FM or download us after broadcast on iTunes or other podcast programs. You can also listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. phone number 701-719-0990. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and including your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. If you would like to sponsor this show as an individual or an advertiser, please contact me. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want the show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information you are gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. If you would like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of on science, medicine, viruses, democracy, or social issues, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. Currently, you can donate via PayPal using david.crowe, that's crowe with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. Go to theinfectiousmyth.com/donate.html for more information. And now let's continue with part two of my discussion with David Stephan over the death of his son Ezekiel and the subsequent legal proceedings. So to recap a little bit, Ezekiel had a health crisis at home, stopped breathing. David and Colette called 911. While they were on the phone with 911, he started breathing again. So the 911 system, Alberta Health Services, decided not to send an ambulance. But it happened again, so they bundled him into the car and they started driving to the hospital. And without knowing it, they passed through the town of Glenwood, where there was actually an ambulance, but they'd not been told and they didn't know this. So they actually met the ambulance on the edge of Cardston, which is the closest town that has a hospital. The ambulance was not equipped at that time with the equipment necessary to intubate a child of that young age. And Ezekiel then went for over 8 minutes between being loaded into the ambulance and the hospital without oxygen. So now, David, thanks for joining me again. We're at the hospital in Cardston. What happened from this point on?
I'll just correct one thing there. So, yeah, he hadn't stopped breathing again until after we'd already got him into the vehicle and were proactively taking him to the hospital, even though he'd start breathing again on his own. And we didn't know why he'd stopped breathing.
Oh, okay, yes. Yeah. So the 911 suggested you just bring him to the hospital.
That's right.
So he'd had one episode of not breathing, and the second episode occurred while you were taking him to the hospital.
That's right.
En route. Okay, sorry for that.
No, that's an important mistake. that's okay. So we get into the hospital, and there's just mass confusion on our end. How did we get to this point? What's going on?
Right.
What's the prognosis? Had no idea. So a freak snowstorm shows up that evening. They can't airlift him from Cardston to the Alberta Children's Hospital in Calgary. And so they take him by ambulance after getting him stabilized. They take him by ambulance to Lethbridge, where they can airlift him from there to Calgary. Colette and I end up going home and are met by my brother and sister-in-law, who assisted in packing us to go to Calgary, because at this point we are not in our right minds at all.
Right.
We can't bring ourselves to do anything. So, in fact, my brother ended up driving us up to Calgary because he felt that we were not in a state of being able to drive on our own at this mm-hmm. point.
Well, especially, and, I mean, you're dealing with a very ill child who's no longer in your custody, and there's bad weather as well.
That's exactly. And so, you know, we're in a complete state of shock.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah,
this completely caught us off guard. I mean, when you take a look back 6 hours before, he is becoming active. He's waking me up from my nap, playing with my lip. He's drinking a lot of electrolyte drink on his own. He's going down, you know, he's having restful sleep, the most restful that he'd had in a few days, with no resemblance of illness at all. And all of a sudden we find ourselves in this situation. So it's a complete shocker to us. It's not, there's no consistent lead up to it that would say, oh my goodness, we should have seen that the illness was progressing and that of course we'd end up in this situation. That wasn't it at all. We were just completely baffled, wondering how in the world did we get here. And so now we're being driven up to Alberta Children's Hospital. We end up actually beating the STARS ambulance up there, and we're waiting for about an hour or close to in the pediatric intensive care unit waiting room before Ezekiel arrives.
Right.
We initially got met by a doctor who was the attending doctor after the arrival of Ezekiel, saying we can't see him yet, he's undergoing tests. But they're talking about a comatose child here. And so it wasn't until later that we discovered they gave him medication that basically put him into a comatose situation. But we're thinking, oh my goodness, he's in a coma. Okay, well, so we're left with some sense of hope that he's in a coma, people come out of comas. Okay.
Right, right. I mean, especially with children, like if a child falls into cold water, often they will stop breathing, but they go into a state where the damage to their brain is not as great as you would think it was. But
right.
And I mean, you're not medically trained people. I mean, I don't really know what the consequences of a coma are, but now you're saying it was artificially induced, which I guess is maybe sometimes necessary if they know it's going to be a while before they get somebody to the hospital.
Well, what it was, why it was induced, and we never found this out until later, and it actually puts a hole in the theory that he had bacterial meningitis so bad that he was dead before he even got to the initial ambulance. Because what happened is we got him to the ambulance, didn't get air for 8 minutes. He has brain death, appearances of brain death when he's in the hospital in Cardston.
Mm-hmm.
We're actually given that scenario that you just laid out there about, you know, don't lose hope, children, you know, we've seen it where they'll fall under the ice for this long and yet they'll still come back. And I'm thinking, how is that relevant? Because I'm not realizing at this point. I don't know what the doctors know. I don't know what the paramedics know, that he just went for 8 minutes without oxygen. I don't know that. So I don't know why that's relevant that they're saying that. And so while he's in transport to the Alberta Children's Hospital, he starts to breathe on his own again, which throws a complete wrench in their theory that, look, he was so overwhelmed with bacterial meningitis. There was so much pressure in the brain. It compressed the brain stem. And caused herniation in there, which there was no scientific evidence of either. Nothing showed up on the CT scan, herniation from brain pressure, nothing. So he started breathing on his own again, and they were concerned about it, so they actually gave him a medication in the STARS ambulance that put him into that comatose situation because they were concerned that he may pull the intubation tubes out.
Oh, from his breathing. So
from him gaining activity again. Which was a miracle in itself,
right,
being that he had just gone for over 8 minutes without oxygen about an hour and a half before. And so here he's starting to show progression, and so they drug him, and he never comes out of that comatose situation. And so would have, you know, had they left it, would it be a different situation today? I don't know. Would he be a vegetable, you know, with major brain damage from the 8 minutes without oxygen? We can only speculate.
There's a lot of what ifs. Like, what if they'd sent the ambulance from? What if they'd realized there was an ambulance at Glenwood and said, "No, stay at home. We're going to send the ambulance. It's only 5 minutes away." What if you'd taken him to the hospital in Cardston and you hadn't had the delay?
Exactly.
There's so many what ifs.
But believe you me, we spent months, you know,
yes,
living the what ifs and the regrets and we spent years doing that. But
so did anything else happen at the Children's Hospital in Calgary before they finally declared that Ezekiel was dead?
No, except for they said that. During transport, and I'm assuming this was due to the medication that they gave him to prevent him from being active, during the transport, there was a period of about 40-45 minutes where his heart had stopped. That was communicated to us right from the get-go. unfortunately, for some reason, it's not in the medical records that we can find anywhere. We haven't been able to find it since then, but it burned an impression right on our mind because they said his heart is in a really bad situation where he could stop at any time. So we were left with the concern, okay, he's in a coma. Hopefully he can come out of it. We know nothing about the fact that he has brain death because he went for 8 minutes without oxygen. Mm-hmm. And we're thinking his heart could potentially stop at any point in time. And they're asking us, do you want to resuscitate if it does? So those are the factors that are before us. And so anyways, we're thinking, okay, you know, there's got to be hope. There's always hope. We're not willing to give up.
Yeah, we're not talking about your 95-year-old grandfather or something, and you know, he lived a good life, and maybe we don't want to resuscitate. This child has a life in front of them. Of course, parents are going to want to do everything possible.
Absolutely. I mean, if I could have traded positions, I would have. So, no parent should ever have to go through a situation like that where, you know, they have to bury their child. It's unnatural. I don't even know if we're wired for it.
Right. But all of the thoughts in your head and all the possible decisions you might have to make, I mean, it's bad enough that your child died, but those couple of days must have been a complete nightmare of not knowing at that point what was going to happen, which is maybe even worse than of what actually happened.
It kind of did become like living a nightmare, where it becomes foggy. What took place? So we'd been up from 7 in the morning that day before when we went to the lawyers and in Lethbridge, and then, you know, by around 8:30, 9 o'clock is, I believe, when the first 911 call was made, you know, in the evening. So we're talking, you know, a full day. Typically people are winding down at about this point, getting ready for bed. We're rushing to the hospital. We're rushing now to Calgary, Alberta Children's Hospital. So now we're talking, you know, we're in the middle of the night here, 3 o'clock in the morning, and we're meeting with doctors there. And so there's no room for sleep. I believe I dozed off in the waiting room while we were waiting for, you know, maybe up to an hour. Maybe. I'm just speculating. I mean, the recollection of memory at this point is a little bit tough just because, you know, in regard to sleep, because, you know, time kind of stood still during all of this. So there's no room for rest. The next morning, by the time we get to see him, we still haven't really slept. My wife hasn't slept at all. And now we're meeting with doctors. You know, basically doctor after doctor after doctor, you know, they're trying to figure out what's going on. And they seem surprised because they seem to be wanting to work off of the diagnosis of bacterial meningitis. And I don't know if it was methodical that they wanted to or if it's just what seemed logical. But what it did serve to do is attempt to minimize the effect that the ambulance would have had with him not getting 8 minutes oxygen.
Well, maybe I can just take a brief pause. And I went to the Mayo Clinic website where they have a little thing on the diagnosis of bacterial meningitis, or just meningitis, they say. But they say that it can be diagnosed based on medical history, a physical exam, and certain diagnostic tests. And some of the tests that may be required are blood cultures. The problem with blood cultures are that it takes several days to culture the bacteria. So at this point in time, they couldn't possibly have had results from blood cultures.
Nope. Nothing ever did show up in his blood culture, by the way.
Right, which is why they know it's not bacterial, right? There was no bacteria. Then there's imaging, CT or magnetic resonance scans.
Yep, and he had a CT scan, and it showed by the time that they did the scan, it showed inflammation, which can also be caused by an hypoxic event, oxygen deprivation. But he did have swelling in the brain that was identified in CT.
That's another symptom that could have 1,001 causes. And then the third thing they talk about is the spinal tap, which doctors love to do, but that's looking for bacteria in the cerebrospinal fluid. And it is a dangerous procedure, can cause problems. But they can find in the spinal fluid, they can find indications of what kind of meningitis it was. But you're saying that there was no scientific evidence at any point that it was bacterial.
That's right. So they used non-clinical methodology when it ended up getting into the medical examiner's office. When they did the autopsy on Ezekiel, they used non-clinical methodology, so it's not even scientifically proven methods, to identify that there was bacteria in the cerebral spinal fluid. Now, the problem is, we're kind of jumping forward here, but the problem is with the testing is it's an amplification process that if there's even one trace of bacteria in an entire sample, it will show up eventually, so you can find what you're looking for. So if you want to determine that it's bacterial meningitis, that's the test you'd want to use.
And that's now, the PCR test.
That's right. But it's not an approved test for that purpose because you will find false positives, and that's exactly what they found. But when you actually look at the samples of cerebral spinal fluid, the type of bacteria that they identified doesn't match the physical explanation that the medical examiner gave. He said there was rod-like bacteria or bacilli, and we later determined it as Haemophilus influenzae, which isn't a rod-like bacilli. It's a cocal bacilli, which is actually a different shape altogether. So what he identified physically by looking did not match what the PCR test found.
I understand. So especially in a post-mortem case, you have much easier access to the cerebral spinal fluid. And if the bacteria are the cause of illness, there should be lots of bacteria in the spinal fluid. And it should match what the polymerase chain reaction, which looks for the DNA or the RNA of the bacteria, it should match it.
Right.
And if the PCR is finding something else, then it's either a false positive or it amplified a bacteria that was not present in quantities sufficient to cause disease.
Or even present at the time of passing. Mm-hmm. After a child passes, or an adult or a human passes, there is transference of bacteria from one area to another. It's a natural process that takes place.
The body loses its ability to maintain its immune defense, and then bacteria starts to take over everything. Yes, so I agree that you probably need to be very careful with post-mortem that you're not identifying bacteria that colonized following death.
That's right. And in a situation like this where the theory is he had bacterial meningitis so bad that it caused brain death, it compressed the spinal or the brainstem and prevented him from breathing and having any motor functions. If that were the case, you should find sufficient levels of the bacteria within the cerebral spinal fluid that it would be pretty easy to identify, where you wouldn't have to jump through major hoops to come up with a false positive. Now, what was discovered is, one, they never did testing for viral meningitis.
Mm-hmm.
So, which to me says, look, if you're doing a thorough examination and there's no biases, you're going to try to find out what the causation of death was. And so you're going to do all the tests that it looks like it could reasonably be. And if you don't find anything there, then you're going to start looking elsewhere.
Well, the PCR test should work on viruses. I mean, I think in the past, viral diseases have often been diagnosed negatively. Like if they can't find, so if you have pneumonia and they can't find any bacteria, they'll call it viral pneumonia. They don't necessarily know that there's actually a virus present, but they know there's no bacteria, so they got to explain it with something.
That's
but
right.
PCR works equally well with bacteria or virus because it works on the genetic material.
As far as I'm aware, you'd have to order a completely different test for the virus. Is what it appeared to be, according to the chief medical examiner. There was no searching for viruses.
Okay, so it would actually still be PCR, but it would be with different primers, because each primer is for a specific, you're looking for a specific bacteria, so you do a specific PCR and see if you get a reaction.
Yes.
So I understand. So they did not actually test for common causes of viral meningitis.
Exactly, and the most common cause of meningitis altogether is viral, and it is enterovirus. And so if somebody gets meningitis, if you're statistically going to make a guess of what it is, it's likely viral and it's likely enterovirus. Now, here's the interesting thing, is that they actually found enterovirus in a throat swab that they did, and which would have been is also the leading cause of croup.
Right.
And so if he did have viral meningitis and he did have croup, it's very, very likely that that enterovirus they actually found in him, in his throat, was the cause of the restricted airway, the croup, and the viral meningitis. Now, when they found that enterovirus in the throat swab, they never examined further. They never actually took a sample of what was going on in the lungs and tested it for virus either. So it was almost like, you know, I'm just looking at the situation here and saying, well, why wouldn't you do the testing there? You're a medical examiner. You're trying to find out what's going on here, but you're shying away from testing what appears to be the obvious, and you're going to great lengths to try to find something else using non-scientifically proven methods that can't actually be used for the situation.
So what would be the political significance of finding that it was bacterial meningitis? I mean, if it was bacterial meningitis, would it be easier to show that it was your fault as opposed to viral? Like, what was their theory behind
this?
Two things.
You identified one. One, because they came up with a theory that he had bacterial meningitis so bad that the ambulance made no difference whatsoever.
Right.
The second thing is, they're no longer culpable for his passing. That's what they're going to try to do, and that's what they did do in the court case. They tried to say he was dead before he got to the ambulance, so regardless of whether they had the right equipment or not, it doesn't make any difference.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's how they laid it out. The second thing was, is when we received the autopsy report, it had information on there saying that this type of bacteria could have been easily prevented through proper vaccinations.
Okay. So that would show you, as irresponsible parents who don't believe in vaccination, I'm assuming, therefore, if you'd vaccinated your child, this never would have happened.
That's basically what they alluded to in the autopsy, but, you know, in more politically correct terms. Now, the thing is that even with the PCR test, and they couldn't say whether it's Haemophilus A, B, C, D, whatever, and they've only got a vaccine for type B. And so, you know, it was a far stretch for them to say that anyways, given that, one, it wasn't actually scientifically proven that he had Haemophilus influenza. And secondly, even if he did, how could you say that a vaccine would have prevented it if you don't know what strain it was? But what they did do, you know, we're talking about agenda here, is when we got into the preliminary trial, the topic of vaccines kept on coming up, and my lawyer stood up and said, hey, look, I object to these questions. Of what relevance are there? Are they? Vaccines aren't going to be a topic within this case as far as more. The Crown prosecutor stood up and said, oh, actually, vaccines are going to be a big topic within this court case. So they had a meeting after, and it was identified. It was actually communicated, not identified. It was communicated to our counsel that there was an agenda here, that what the Crown was wanting to do was establish the precedent that if you are a parent within Canada and you choose not to vaccinate,
right,
that you can be held criminally liable for any harm that befalls your child if they contract an illness that was deemed to be vaccine preventable.
So so they're saying that it was bacterial meningitis, Haemophilus influenza?
That's correct.
And yet they didn't find bacterial particles that looked like the Haemophilus influenza, which you're saying is rod-like bacterial particles.
Well, he identified it as rod-like, but that identifies a typical bacilli, whereas Haemophilus influenza is a coccobacilli, meaning it has a different shape altogether.
Oh, so it's not rod-like. So they found rod-like bacteria, but that didn't match the PCR. But you're also saying that there's three types of Haemophilus influenza, and there's only a vaccine against one. So
no,
unless
there's hundreds, or there could be hundreds.
Okay.
There's only, I think, about 10 that have been specified, if that. And then there's all the unspecified. So there could be hundreds, there could be thousands. They don't know. They're just not classified at this point.
So
yes,
if it was one that the vaccine isn't targeted against, then that theory would fall apart. But they didn't actually prove it was a specific type of Haemophilus influenza.
That's right. Well, they couldn't actually prove that it was Haemophilus influenza in the first place. The protocols that they used for the testing ended up being lost. We couldn't get the reports that actually took place showing that the PCR testing actually did in fact take place. It wasn't available to us. We'd made requests for the disclosure, and turns out that they were nowhere to be found. And so we don't even know if the PCR testing actually ever took place. There is no evidence of it taking place.
So, but did a doctor testify in court that it took place?
Yes, the medical examiner testified that it took place. That it took place in June 2014 during the preliminary trial. At that same time, now this is where it gets interesting, and this is what led us to hire an independent medical examiner to review the file. At the same time, he also testified that the ambulance could have been played a role in his death. And then when we got into trial at the beginning of 2016 here, he retestified saying that the ambulance would have played no role whatsoever in his passing, and that's why he didn't put it on the autopsy report. And so with his conflicting evidence from 1 year to the next, we decided that, this man is not a man of integrity, and so we need to hire another medical examiner to take a look at this. And we were completely shocked and surprised at what we found, that there was actually, according to her, no scientific evidence whatsoever to say that it was Haemophilus influenza, that his evidence was completely conflicting, and that actually all the evidence leads to show that it was actually viral meningitis. And then she went into the stats on that, showing that had he been intubated, it would have been about 100% chance of full recovery.
And he couldn't be intubated because the ambulance was not stocked. I mean, this shouldn't really be a surprise to you because the history of medical examiners and prosecutors medical examiners and medical experts trying to prove that the police, that the prosecutors are right, is very common. I mean, in the case of shaken baby syndrome, which now people, even in mainstream media, are saying was probably completely invented syndrome, and that even though there's thousands of people who've been convicted of shaken baby syndrome, there have been many cases, like in Toronto, Charles Smith, a top pediatrician, who clearly had the aim of proving the theory of the prosecutors, the police, correct. He went into court to show that the parents had shaken their baby or that the caregiver had shaken the baby, not to examine the evidence dispassionately. So every time he went into court, he found the parents or the other caregivers were guilty.
Yeah.
I don't think that's an uncommon thing. I think the medical examiner is working for the government, the prosecutor is working for the government, the police are working for the government. Just kind of a feeling that they're all working for the same thing.
They all work for the crown.
But your theory that they're trying to show that if you don't vaccinate, you could be criminally responsible is very concerning.
No, not actually a theory. They actually communicated that openly.
Mm-hmm. But in verbally or in writing?
Well, verbally to our counsel. And so what we had to do because of that, because this was going to be a precedent-setting case,
obviously,
in Canada, because they can't side skirt around the Constitution of Canada, which prevents mandatory vaccinations. So what they need to do was set a precedent in law to scare parents into vaccinating because, okay, we can't force you, but guess what?
If you don't vaccinate, you're going to go to jail.
That's right. I actually went down to Chicago, flew down to Chicago during the Autism One conference and met with some of the leading experts in the world regarding the concerns about vaccinations. We put together a defense team using Dr. Tony Bark and Dr. Tatiana Obakanich, who are very credible, well-versed experts, doctors that know their stuff. And so we put together a defense and completely blew the vaccine case apart, showing that, one, there would be no safeguard against, you know, had he even been vaccinated for Haemophilus influenza, that even if it was Haemophilus influenza type B that he had, there would be no assurance that, one, that he wouldn't contract it and die from it, because we pulled up all the stats showing how, you know, children who are being vaccinated with that vaccine are still dying from Haemophilus influenza type B infections. Two, it was identified that using the government databases that there was risks about vaccinating, there was many deaths, thousands of deaths, shown in conjunction with the vaccination of the Haemophilus influenza type B vaccine. And so we identify that, one, you know, it can be risky taking it, and two, even if you have it, there's no safeguard against getting it. And that was evidence that they likely didn't want before the court. So just prior to getting into trial and seeing the expert witnesses that we had lined up to testify on the vaccine issue, they dropped it. They dropped the vaccine issue altogether. And so the vaccine agenda went out the window. And which was a great thing, was a real great thing. I'm glad that they actually attempted to push that agenda through with us, because we had, at that time, we had the resources at least to put together a defense, whereas the average person wouldn't have had the ability to fly down to Chicago to meet with these individuals, wouldn't have had the connections to be able to do that. And so it was a fortunate thing
and unfortunate, because if they had insisted of stubbornly putting it forwards and lost, it would have been, you know, a precedent that they, you know, much less likely to use. I mean, they might try to use it again, maybe when they figure that there's more vulnerable parents or something like that.
Yeah. So there's the element that I wish that they would have proceeded with it, so that we could have got that evidence before the courts. But once we did get into court and saw how everything rolled out, and how our evidence was suppressed as much as it possibly could have been, I don't trust that it would have been a fair trial anyways for getting that kind of evidence in.
Right, but they did convict you and your wife of, I forget the exact charge of, basically negligence. That's not exactly the words. So on what basis did they say that you were negligent?
Oh, all right, yeah, so this is where it gets interesting, because the media, the way that they've communicated it would lead somebody to believe that we were responsible for his death, and that it was our negligence that led up to that, and based on our belief system. When in fact, what took place in the courtroom, anybody who was there, and there was quite a few people there, what they saw was completely different. The actual facts that were presented there showed that one, causation of death was never put on us, and the Crown refused to go there because they knew that it would have been a really tough thing or tough stretch to make, because the jury was privy to all the evidence about the ambulance issues, and that he went for over 8 minutes without oxygen, and that, according to most experts, that would have been the cause of death. And so they never went for cause of death. So what they did do, though, is they went for endangerment. Did the Steffens endanger their son? And would it have been foreseeable to the, you know, a reasonably prudent parent? And if so, was it done at a time that medical intervention could have, not would have, those were the actual words, could have, not would have, made a difference? And so the jury had to say, okay, they had to take a look at it and say, did they endanger him? And was it foreseeable? Would have any other parent thought? Well, hindsight, unfortunately, clouds that making that judgment, I would say.
Well, I think hindsight makes it clearer, right? I mean, if you know exactly what happened, you can say, well, why didn't you call the ambulance 24 hours earlier? There might not have been any trigger for you to do that. But, you know, looking backwards, you can say, well, gee, if you called it 24 hours later, then maybe none of this would have all happened. Of course, Nobody could know that.
Exactly. So in the situation when you're there, before he passes, you know, it's a different story than, okay, after he passes, to everybody, of course it becomes obvious. Well, he passed away, so of course he was in danger.
But, I mean, you've got from February 27th till his death on this, well, he went to the Children's Hospital on the 14th, so that's 14, that's like 3 weeks, right?
No, So it was the 13th that we ended up in the first hospital. By the time we got to the Children's Hospital, it would have been like 2, 3 in the morning.
No, but what I'm saying is he first got sick on February 27th, which is about 3 weeks before he died. So you could second guess, 2.5 weeks, but you could second guess every one of those days. You could say, well, this happened, so you should have gone to the hospital. This happened, you should have gone to the hospital.
Right.
But,
that's right.
You know, as I said before, if you'd gone to the hospital right away on the 27th, the doctors, if they'd been perfect doctors, they would have told you to go home because it couldn't possibly be meningitis. Because if they could see the future, they would say it's still going to be 2.5 weeks before he has this health crisis.
That's right. You're absolutely right. And you know, had we taken him in 4 days later, they would have said, oh, okay, so he had these symptoms before and he's getting better. Well, he's getting better.
Why are you bothering us?
That's right. And then the next week, you know, when I came home and it looked like he had the flu and he's getting better by the next day, had we taken him in then? Oh, it looks like he has the flu and he's getting better. Okay, yeah, why are you bothering us, right? There's nothing emergent. There's nothing alarming here. He doesn't even have a fever. So, yeah, you're right. But in hindsight, when you look at it, well,
right.
you realize, oh, he passed away. I think that having that knowledge clouds one's judgment because, you know, you have the judgment saying, of course you should have. He passed away. You should have taken him at this point or this point. It makes, yeah, anyways.
I can see a jury buying the, if only they'd called the ambulance 24 hours later, and why didn't you do that? And then with all this stuff about using alternative remedies, not vaccinating and stuff, all that floating around, you could say, well, parents who vaccinate, parents who don't believe in alternative remedies, they would have called the ambulance sooner. I could see them buying that, even though, you know, the trigger to call the ambulance was that he stopped breathing. There was nothing 24 hours before that, was there, that would have been a trigger to call 911?
No. I mean, 24 hours before that, that's when my father had seen him, made no recommendations to go to the hospital, never voiced any concerns about his health, and you know, 28 hours before that is when he would have been being viewed by an emergency room nurse who said, look, you take him into the hospital, you're likely going to be turned away.
Did that nurse ever testify?
What's that?
Did that nurse testify in court?
She did testify. Unfortunately, she didn't testify to that, saying that I told them not to take him in or made the recommendation. What she did testify to, she testified that she checked his vitals. There was nothing apparent of emergent situation. There was nothing alarming. Everything came out clear. So she testified to that. What she did testify to, though, is she said, you might want to take him in just for a second opinion. That's what she testified in regard to her conversation with my wife. Now, I specifically recall, that day, you know, because I was concerned for my wife, and I'm thinking, oh, my goodness, okay, well, you know, when I get home, am I going to be getting it again after this meeting, whatever? And she was in completely good mood, and she relayed exactly what stuck out to her, and it was that, you know, the vitals were good. She wasn't alarmed. I'm reassured by the conversation, and, you know, if we were to take him into the hospital, that we'd be turned away based on, you know, that's what she communicated.
I can see a nurse being careful about what she says in court, because of course if they don't come down heavy on you, they might decide that the nurse was negligent.
That's right.
So things might get slightly edited to make it, you know, look like she was covering her ass.
That's right, exactly. And that's what I assume it is, but you know, we're talking 4 years after the fact that we're in court, so How well does one's memory serve them in regard to that?
Yeah, it may be that, over time, she, anybody's memory could have changed, but it's possible that as she went over it, she might have convinced herself that she had said all the things that she's now thinking she should have said, and that over time it becomes, people can modify their memories. People who study memories know that they're quite fallible.
Yeah.
So the the jury found you guilty of negligence basically because you didn't call an ambulance or take the Ezekiel to the hospital sooner.
Yeah. Whether or not it would have made a difference was not a factor that needed to be taken into consideration. It was, you know, did they you know, not take them in at a time that a reasonably prudent parent would have. And so that's what they found us guilty on, was endangering his life, not the causation of his death. Now, that was also in light of the fact that they had received 3 weeks of testimony of cumulative evidence over and over and over about how dangerous bacterial meningitis is, what, you know, doctors saying what a parent should have been doing in this situation. And it turns out that all that evidence was irrelevant anyways by the time that we discovered that bacterial meningitis wasn't actually a factor, and that, of course, we didn't see the symptoms of bacterial meningitis. Like we communicated, we never did. To the doctors, to the police when we were under investigation, none of that came out because we never saw the symptoms of bacterial meningitis. But yet here they are telling the jury about, you know, the severe symptoms over and over and over, expert witness after expert witness after expert witness, and it was all cumulative.
So if you talk about bacterial meningitis long enough, people are going to kind of neglect where did they prove that it was bacterial meningitis. Now, you said that this expert witness you had, who was a former medical examiner for Alberta?
The former chief medical examiner for Alberta.
Former chief medical examiner. And pardon, is it a woman or a man?
It's a woman,
right.
And she would still be the chief medical examiner of Alberta if it wasn't for the fact that she actually blew the whistle on the corruption that was taking place within the chief medical examiner's office, where there was politicians and bureaucrats getting involved and getting evidence to be fudged for various purposes.
Okay, and do you mind using her name? Like, who is this woman?
Yeah, it's Dr. Annie Savageau.
Savageau. Okay. And did she testify in court on your behalf?
She did.
And so she testified that she didn't think it was bacterial meningitis that Ezekiel had died of.
She testified that there was no scientific evidence that she could find whatsoever that would support that diagnosis, as well as, so there were two listed causations of death. One was bacterial meningitis. The second was a right pleural empyema, which is an infection on the outer wall of the lung in the pleural cavity.
Right.
And it can eventually prevent breathing from taking place. And so what she did find, though, as well, so there's the two listed causations of death, is that the right pleural empyema was not a causation of death whatsoever because it didn't exist on the 13th when Ezekiel passed away and ended up in the ambulance. The right pleural empyema began to develop while he was in Alberta Children's Hospital.
Oh, I see. So
there were x-rays to prove that, but the x-ray was never disclosed to us.
Oh, okay. So now I don't want to run out of time again, but so this, has the sentence been suspended while there's an appeal going on?
Yeah, so the sentence has been suspended until the appeal goes
right
through.
Now, both sides are appealing. So presumably the prosecution service felt that your sentence, I believe 4 months of prison and your wife's 3 months house arrest plus community service plus probation, they didn't think that was anywhere near severe enough. I mean, what were they asking for?
They were asking for 3 to 4.5 years imprisonment.
For both of you?
Yeah, and initially they were asking for far less than that. And then shortly after, I began speaking out publicly on the matter and what took place in court and how the media is lying, outright lying about the situation, trying to make us look like a bunch of crazies, and they refused to talk about the fact that the ambulance was
right,
listed as causation of death. Once I started speaking out about all that, all of a sudden, they came back with a recommendation for 3 to 4.5 years, which was a major jump from what they were actually originally asking for.
Right, right. And this is for both of you.
That's right.
Whereas the judge basically gave house arrest to your wife. So even if the sentence is executed, your wife will still be at home with the children. Whereas if you both go to jail, then the children will get shipped out to relatives or foster care or something, right?
I mean, that's right.
What are the major bases for your appeal? Like, what are the, you know, top two or three things that you believe went wrong? Maybe you've covered them all, but maybe you can just go over them.
So the trial judge, one, allowed evidence, cumulative evidence, to come forward on behalf of the Crown. And so basically opened up the floodgates for the Crown to be able to have all of the expert witnesses that they wanted, basically saying the same rhetoric over and over and over, which goes against the principles of justice. You know, it's kind of like reverse oath helping, where you just have, you know, multiple people saying the same thing over and over and over. And it's a principle that Hitler put into place, where you tell a big enough lie, you tell it often enough, and it becomes the truth in people's minds. So the judge allowed for that to take place, which was not proper. The second thing is that the judge limited our evidence from coming forward. So Dr. Annie Savageau was limited in the scope that she can talk about.
Mm-hmm.
My father couldn't actually even talk about why he didn't make the recommendation to go to the hospital. He couldn't speak on much at all other than, well, this is what I saw.
Right.
So he was limited as well. Those are two major elements, is the fact that the Crown was allowed to proceed as they saw fit, as much as they possibly could, and yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it shouldn't matter if you repeat something many times. I mean, if it's not right, it shouldn't matter if it gets repeated a million times. But I can see that in court, if you keep saying this about bacterial meningitis, this about bacterial meningitis, pretty soon the jury's going, well, it must be bacterial meningitis, because everybody's standing up and talking about it. I know that in a case in England, one of two pediatric neuroscientists in England, I believe, started testifying against shaken baby syndrome, and she was struck off the medical register under quite strange circumstances. But she heard from somebody who'd been at a conference in the United States that one of the policemen in the United States, one of the people involved with the group that does, you know, child deaths, you know, and child crimes, things like that, he bragged that every time somebody testified for the defense in a shaken baby syndrome case, they went after them and got rid of them, and they never testified again. I mean, has Dr. Savage experienced any pushback from the fact that she testified on your behalf?
Oh yeah, she came under fire. She definitely came under fire for it. She was already under fire because she is a whistleblower, and she's
right.
Currently going against the chief medical examiner's office, and I think the Department of Justice within Alberta, because
right.
They fired her under wrongful terms.
Yeah, I mean, it's very difficult for the public to know, because people get fired because they're incompetent, but they also get fired because they're trying to clean up a toxic environment, toxic or corrupt environment. We don't have a lot of time left, but I would like to talk about your father's company. We talked a little bit about this in the previous episode I did with Gillian Skeet. But you work for True Hope, which is a supplement company created by your father, and it was attacked by Health Canada many years ago and told to stop producing supplements, stop selling supplements, but they actually prevailed, right? You're still in business today. Can you briefly, in about a couple of minutes, describe the saga of True Hope?
Oh, absolutely. So my grandfather ended up taking his life. My mother, after going through about 10 years of a roller coaster, after being discovered that it was bipolar disorder that she was suffering with, went to a doctor, got a prescription for Prozac in January of 1994, and ended up taking her own life about 2 weeks after getting that prescription for Prozac.
That's not uncommon, unfortunately, Prozac.
No,
suicide.
It is. Right, and what we've discovered since then is that you know, Prozac can increase your risk of suicide substantially.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was two of my siblings, my father having 13 children, not at the time, but at that time, nine biological children and one adopted daughter. Two of my siblings had the same disorder my mother had, and they were medicated. One of my one sibling, my sister, was on a cocktail of five medications, and it wasn't working at all.
Mm-hmm.
It was at best sedated. And so my father began looking elsewhere, and after a great deal of prayer and seeking out for inspiration, came across evidence that proper nutrition can actually alleviate these disorders. And so he set out to heal my siblings. Mm-hmm. And it worked eventually. He discovered what it took, met some key individuals that helped in the process, and as a result, eventually True Hope was started up so that more people could be healed as well and not go through the same situation that my family did.
And I guess the problem with Health Canada is that you were promoting a supplement as actually having health benefits. And of course, Health Canada wants to reserve that privilege for drugs often, which don't do very much. But
yeah, the problem actually arose after the first study took place out of the University of Calgary, showing that the supplements were over three times more effective than your standard antidepressants.
Oops.
And as soon as the study
big mistake.
Out, as soon as the study hit the news, it went on national news the very next day. Health Canada was breathing down our throats.
So it might just be a coincidence that the company that beat back Health Canada, an offspring, your dad was a founder, obviously. So the son of the founder is now attacked by the medical establishment for supposedly causing the death of his own son. That's... seems like a bit of a coincidence.
Well,
you would be the person chosen.
I run the Canadian retail division,
right,
where we put it into stores across Canada, and my main role is actually traveling around Western Canada for the most part, putting on presentations with either health shows or educational seminars with health food stores. So I do a lot of presentations. I'm a bit of a, well, anyways, I'm out in the public a fair bit.
Right.
And so, of course, you know, by silencing me, it's also going to slow down the work that's moving forward.
I mean, there's no shortage of critics of antidepressants. I mean, when you mentioned Prozac, I think the book Let Them Eat Prozac, from memory here, I think is the book written by David Healy, who was a mainstream psychiatrist, you know, drug-oriented psychiatrist who started to become very concerned about the risk of suicide and violent behavior from Prozac and similar antidepressants. And he actually ended up writing this book about some of his experiences. He was fired from a job at the University of Toronto, which was sponsored by Eli Lilly, the manufacturer of Prozac, at least at that time. He was fired before he actually started the job because he spoke out saying that it elevates the risk of suicide. But there's one other thing before we go, which is maybe the influence of religion, because David Healy found himself allied with Scientologists who are very, very opposed to antidepressants and psychiatric medications for their own reasons. I don't buy all the reasons they have, but I mean, I think they're right in their opposition. And are you Mormon, if you don't mind me asking?
I am Mormon, yes.
Yeah, because I just guessed from Cardston is the part of Canada which has the highest fraction of Mormons, and it seems like there's freedom of religion in Canada, but when something goes wrong, then religion gets used against people. You must be irrational. You don't believe in science if you're religious.
Yeah, actually, in regard to Mormons, that wouldn't necessarily apply. When you take a look at the state of Utah, they are the number one users of psychiatric medications. They have one of the highest rates of vaccinations. They have the highest rates of suicides, and they have one of the highest rates of autism as well. And so they are, when it comes to Mormons in typical, they are users of the medical system more so than just any other demographic.
So we're not talking, I mean, Scientology specifically preaches against the use of psychiatric drugs, but you're saying that's not the case at all with Mormons.
No, in fact, it's the opposite, and it's taking its toll. I mean, when you take a look at the stats,
right.
You have the highest rate of suicide in the state of Utah, that's a problem. Highest rate of autism, that's a problem.
The highest rate of autism, which, yes, we've talked about on this show, and I want to talk about it more in the future. I wish we could talk longer, but you now have the record for my guest who's talked the longest since we're doing two shows out of basically one conversation. I would really like to thank you for speaking out about this, and I again express my sympathy to your family, and I hope that you prevail in the future, and that the truth comes out. So thank you very much for joining me today. I think it's been a fascinating conversation.
Thank you so much, David. I appreciate you having me on, and we'll see where it all goes and hope that justice prevails.
Yes, and I will send you a link to the podcast, which will be available after it airs.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Okay. Goodbye.
Okay. Bye, David.
It is interesting to me how hard society can come down on parents who avoid medical interventions such as drug or vaccines when one of their children mysteriously dies. But society as a whole, and the medical industry specifically, avoids talking about any possible influence of drugs in tragic deaths. Take the Fort Lauderdale airport shooting, for example. Esteban Santiago appears to have been delusional for some time. Was this due to his PTSD, which is a predictable outcome of sending young people to foreign countries that they don't understand, where they are supposed to be violent and will probably see violence? Violence against their buddies in the military and violence against the civilians they are supposed to be protecting. The consequent condition that we call PTSD, since it has a name, it is often treated with psychiatric drugs that can increase the risk of not only suicide, but violent behavior. I recommend David Healy's 2000 book, Let Them Eat Prozac, to see how bad this is. That's not to say this was the cause in this case, but the death penalty is the ultimate way for society to say, we have no responsibility for what happened to you when we sent you to war, and we're not interested in the violent side effects of the drugs you may have taken after you came back. In Canada, also recently, an Afghanistan veteran, Lionel Desmond, also suffering from PTSD and possibly a physical brain injury as well, shot and killed his wife, daughter, and mother before killing himself. In this case, it is known that he is being treated for PTSD, but the press seems singularly uninterested in knowing whether this includes drugs that can trigger violent and suicidal behavior. Finally, we have the absurd spectacle of Carrie Fisher being buried in a giant Prozac capsule. She was diagnosed bipolar after struggling with alcoholism and drug addiction. She died of a heart attack, which a 2011 study said is a risk of antidepressants, although later studies have done some statistical magic to make the risk disappear by adjusting for the severity of depression, which is, of course, correlated with the amount of psychiatric drugs taken. Carrie Fisher is admired because she admitted she was mentally ill and took drugs for it. Nobody wants to know if her so-called disease was a consequence of drug and alcohol overuse, let alone to go back and ask why so many famous people and so many soldiers end up addicted to substances and also using psychiatric drugs. Thank you for listening to episode 127 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Or follow us on Twitter @InfectiousMyth. Until next week, goodbye.